Welcome back to another episode of the Damage Report. I'm John Arola. We've got a big show. Not only a little bit more fallout from the weekend and Monday's ridiculous lapse into the racist mind of Donald Trump with his, I would say, I guess, a defense of his comments. We're going to respond to that. We've got just so much as well. We're going to get into a poll that was apparently released by an anonymous group affiliated with some top level Democrats that is just pure refined BS. And so we're going to respond to that. We've got Eric Garner updates on that, not too surprising, unfortunately. Where do the Democratic candidates in this primary stand on reforming and strengthening our democracy as it is eroded, both naturally over time and from the assaults of people like Donald Trump? We've got more on what's going on in Sudan, as well as ways that you can help out with many of the people who were injured in some of the recent violence there, or the families of those who were killed by paramilitary groups. And then finally, obviously the most important news of the day, a black woman was cast to be 007. And so a certain type of person in America is losing their mind over it. And so Brett Ehrlich and I, who are both big fans of the franchise, are going to talk about that as well. But first, we're going to jump into the big news of the day with Donald Trump. Donald Trump is a racist, and he said a bunch of racist things recently. And some people noticed that and have asked him why it is that he did that. Does he actually consider himself to be a racist? And you'll be shocked to find out that he does not.
Does it concern you that many people saw that tweet as racist and that white nationalist groups are finding common cause with you on that point?
It doesn't concern me because many people agree with me. And all I'm saying, they want to leave, they can leave. Now, it doesn't say leave forever. It says leave if you want. But what it says, what that says is, if they're not happy with the United States, if they're doing nothing but criticizing us all the time, you see these people walking down criticizing the United States, we just hit the highest stock market in history. All of these incredible manufacturers that are in, these are great business people, they employ many people, and we have workers with us too. They're having the best year they've ever had. Can I say that? Is that a correct statement?
Okay, so there's a lot of issues with that there. So first of all, I didn't say forever, you know, they can go there for a fortnight or so and then come back. That's the weirdest sort of like 7-year-old caught in a lie defense where he tries to play with the wording a little bit. That's a grown man with that pathetic defense. I just meant they should go back to their country for a long weekend, perhaps. That's not at all what he meant. The general point that he's just bothered by the fact that these women have an issue with our government, some of our policies, and that they're criticizing it. And he just can't stand for that. Nobody actually believes that's why he's attacking these women. Nobody thinks that the right just can't stand criticism. What was all those Tea Party representatives elected on? We love America and we don't want anything to ever change ever in terms of our policies. No, they had big issues with the economic policy of the US, blah, blah, blah. You know, a lot of their ideology fell apart after a couple years in office, but they came in with some criticisms. You gotta give them that. And in terms of the criticisms, you know, Donald Trump, Parker Malloy pointed this out. Donald Trump wrote a book called Crippled America. He thought it was so bad in this country that the country was crippled, but he doesn't like criticisms of America. And overall, I gotta give credit to Jonathan Ladd on Twitter who pointed out, like his point is, if you don't like America, you should get out. And people have been saying that sort of thing for a very long time. Racists like Donald Trump. There's been a lot of activity on Twitter, both regular people and celebrities talking about how often they have been told, people of color, how often they've been told to leave this country. And Jonathan Ladd pointed out that there's really only been one group that hated America that they tried to leave, and it was white Southerners, and it didn't go well for them. So that's the people that tried to leave America. The rest of us, we're very happy to try to make it into the country that it needs to be. But let's go to his primary point there. That is that it's pointed out to him that white supremacists, white nationalists not only use that language, the sort of language that Donald Trump used over the weekend, but after he said those things, they have lauded those comments saying, yes, this is what we want to hear. Racists love that sort of language. Now, does that bother him? No, because a lot of people agree with me. Well, yes, we get that. We're pointing out the sort of people that agree with you. That should be a problem, but it's not for him. And the thing is, it's horrendous, obviously, to imply that if many people believe a thing, then there's no problem with it. That's not how the world works. But it's not exactly like he's wrong. There are a lot of people who agree with the sort of racist sentiments that he expressed over the weekend, and those that have been the foundation of his political and economic career. Did you know that just as of last year, nearly 20% of Americans still thought that interracial marriage was morally wrong? So that means that if you walk around in a crowd, a significant chunk of the people that you pass have a moral problem with two people who love each other getting together, which is about as a twisted version of morality as I can possibly imagine. That was a year ago. Another area of this sort of thing, let's take a look at a poll from earlier this year. 30% of white Americans thought that being white doesn't help or hurt at all. 14% of white Americans said that being white is a disadvantage in America. That is a bizarre stance to take. And by the way, what percentage of those 30% who say it neither helps nor hurts believe deep down that whites are a superior race in some sense? They don't want to admit it publicly, but they certainly think it. So he is wrong in every way that a person can be wrong, except in that many people agree with him, because we are surrounded by a lot of racism. And it's our job to continue to acknowledge that, because 20 to 30 to 40% of the country both have deep racist beliefs and an inability to ever acknowledge that it exists, or that that our politicians have those beliefs, or that many of our policies and institutions are founded, deeply founded on racism and continue to be. That's a big issue. Now there's a lot of stuff sort of floating around this. I know that even responding to the degree that I already have, some people think that it's a waste of time. People that I respect, including AOC, said it's a distraction. And I do agree to some extent that it is a distraction. I'm gonna return to that point in just a little bit. But it's also very, very important. And so I think that it does deserve some of our time to respond to it, as others have. Bernie Sanders said recently, if there's anything sadder than having a racist, bigoted president, it's seeing the collapse of the Republican Party, that they have not stood up as a party and said, we cannot be the party of racism and divisiveness. I actually think Bernie's not going nearly far enough. It's not just that they haven't stood up to it, it's that they apparently decided around the time after the 2014 elections, maybe the 2012, where they had that a report on what they needed to do to win elections, and the advice came back, hey, maybe stop being so racist. They decided, no, that is in fact our future. We're gonna double and triple and octuple down, as Brett has written there, or it might have been Jacori, on this as a strategy. And we're gonna do it through racist dog whistles like Donald Trump did right there. We're gonna do it by trying to make every election about caravans and MS-13. Never mind the fact that that was a complete failure for them in the 2018 midterms. And I look forward to them failing by trying to make that the centerpiece of the campaign in 2020. Let's talk about your border policy. I don't mind at all having that conversation, but that is the path that they've gone down. But back to Donald Trump, because he's not apologizing, certainly, for what he said, but he is responding. And he tweeted this morning, those tweets were not racist, capital R. I don't have a capital R, racist bone in my body. The so-called vote to be taken, talking about the House condemnation vote, is a Democrat con game. Republicans should not show weakness and fall to their trap. This blah, 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 something about filthy language, because we all know Donald Trump, he will not abide filthy language or filthiness of any sort. But when I saw that, I responded the way I think a lot of you did. I know Brett talked to me about it earlier today, about the racist bone in his body. And I wanted to make a point about that, but unfortunately AOC, as she so often does, she got to it before me on Twitter saying, you're right, Mr. President, you don't have a racist bone in your body. You have a racist mind in your head and a racist heart in your chest. That's why you violate the rights of children and tell the congresswoman who represents your home borough to go back to my country. And she's 100% right. Like, racism is not a thing that develops in your marrow. It's a metaphorical weakness in the way you think about the world. It's derived by sexual weakness and economic weakness and just generally being a stupid, ignorant person and thinking that the problems in your life are caused not by your own fundamental, sometimes loudly screamed flaws in a variety of different aspects of your life, but it's caused by black and brown people who are off living their own lives. They're the reasons that your life isn't what you dreamed it would be. And if you believe that not only are they to blame for your issues, but they need to be dealt with. Nothing else. Don't worry about some sort of change to healthcare policy that'll make it easier for you to deal with sickness. Don't worry about any sort of economic policy that'll make it easier for you to get paid a wage that you deserve. If you believe that attacking those people is a solution to your problems, you are a moron. But you're also the only thing that the Republican Party has going for them right now. That's their ideology. You are their target if that's what you believe. It's not in your bones, it's a weakness deep in who you are. And yeah, the right loves to say that those who acknowledge the sorts of things, who acknowledge white privilege, racism, institutionalized racism, that we're being weak in some way. No, acknowledging how people try to get out of jail free on the issues that they have caused for themselves in their lives, that's not weakness, that is strength. And it should really be the minimum bar for being a member, a functioning member of our government. Now, related to this though, I do have to turn to one other topic, and that again has to do with the squad and a particular talking point that Donald Trump is using against them. In his tweets this morning against AOC, Ilhan Omar, and others, Donald Trump used a particular, what seems like a statistic that I have to respond to, because Donald Trump does not come out as the worst person when he's using this. So he said, Congresswoman, he'd been talking earlier, it's not important, who I truly believe based on their actions hate our country, get a list of the horrible things they have said. Omar, Representative Ilhan Omar, is polling at 8%. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, her name is not Cortez, but we'll pass over it, at 21%. Nancy Pelosi tried to push them away, but now they're forever wedded to the Democrat Party. See you in 2020. Well, that is true, we will see you. But those numbers, Ilhan Omar's polling at 8%? Ocasio-Cortez at 21%, really? They just won an election like 8 months ago. How could Ilhan Omar be at 8% in her district? Oh, because it's not a poll of her district at all. It's not a poll even of all people in the country at all. It is a very carefully crafted, to the extent that we know it was crafted at all, poll designed to destroy Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, and others. But the thing is, Donald Trump didn't make this poll. Democrats made this poll. And that is what is so sickening about this. So Daniel Dale provides some more details. Those are not Omar's or Ocasio-Cortez's poll numbers in their districts or in the country. Trump was referring to a poll of white likely voters with 2 years or less of college. Axios published it without saying who did it or provided it and without full details. And so in this case, Donald Trump is not the worst. Axios is worse than Donald Trump. They're not the worst though, but Axios, which believes that it's a journalistic enterprise, that's what it is. They do reporting. They were given this poll and they're hiding who did it. They're hiding the methodology. Was there methodology? I have no idea. They're simply reporting a poll that was given to them by Democrats who want to undercut Ilhan Omar, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and others. And think about this. Not only are they publishing this anonymous poll that for all we know is completely fraudulent at a time when they're being attacked by Donald Trump in this incredibly racist way, but the Democrats who made this poll decided to release it exactly when AOC and the rest of the squad are being attacked. At a time when four women of color in our government are being attacked by a racist, out of control president, Axios and these anonymous cowardly Democrats decided this is the time that we're going to attack them by releasing a poll that only polls white voters who are likely to vote and have basically no education. And where do they live? We have no idea. Are these white likely voters across America, in swing states, in Florida? I have no idea. We have no idea. As far as we know, Axios has no idea, but that did not stop them from releasing this poll. We don't know anything about the methodology. We don't have any idea what the questions that were asked were, but we do know that some people are using this opportunity to try to take down their political opponents. And the problem is not primarily with Donald Trump. Yes, he's gonna use this fraudulent polling, which is another reason why it's so insidious that Axios and the Democrats decided to release it, that they're giving Donald Trump ammunition for his racist attacks against these women of color, but that they decided to do it in the first place. That a Democratic group decided to poll a group that by its very nature is not going to vote for Democrats. Did you know, by the way, that when you poll that sort of voter, they don't like Joe Biden or Nancy Pelosi either? No, that's not in the Axios thing. Weird that they left that out, implying that it's only people like Ilhan Omar and AOC that they have a problem with. Turns out they don't vote for Democrats at all, actually. But no, they decided to do that at exactly the time when we, as responsible people, should be defending these women. They decided to go on the attack instead, and they hid behind anonymity, cowardly hiding, and not revealing anything that we can actually respond to. I don't know who actually did it. I would love for them to be identified, because there is no place for them in the Democratic Party. Anyone involved in this, if they're with the DNC or some affiliated group, they're being cited as top Democrats. They should be out of the party. And remember, by the way, how many times they've said, we shouldn't be attacking each other at this sort of time. Bernie Sanders, don't criticize Joe Biden. That only gives Donald Trump ammunition. Oh, by the way, we have a BS poll that we're going to give to you so you can attack AOC and Ilhan Omar with totally made up numbers. That's totally fine. But let's not have a debate about Medicare for all or anything like that. This is just disgusting. And it's for once a time when Donald Trump is one of the least disgusting parts of this. Okay, we have a lot more that I wish we could talk about on this, but we are going to move on. We're going to take a break. When we come back, our democracy is in peril. Let's look at some ideas on how to reform it.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
you must unlearn what you have learned.
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
In many ways, our democracy is in desperate need of some changes, but thankfully, some of the Democrats in this primary actually have some plans. And joining us now to help break it down, both the issues that need to be solved and what some of these candidates aim to do about it, we're joined now by author and activist Adam Eichen. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Thanks so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Glad to have you here. So you've written some opinion pieces recently about some issues with our democracy and reforms that are needed. Before we get into some of the ideas of these candidates, what do you see as some of the major issues that need to be addressed?
Well, I think there's no question that our democracy is in crisis, that the average American has near zero political influence, according to political scientists, and the wealthy have overwhelming influence. And so clearly we have to reform the way elections are funded in the United States through systems like public financing of elections. We need to ensure that every American has the right to vote. We need to end gerrymandering, get rid of the Electoral College, ensure that every American has an equal voice in our democracy. And there are many policy solutions that can make that happen, which is why it's so exciting that a lot of the Democratic candidates for president are talking about it finally.
So I'm curious, this is sort of a devil's advocate thing, but we're going to be mainly talking about the Democratic candidates for the rest of this. Can you think of, as you've been researching this, can you think of in the last few years an effort led by Republicans that would address one of these issues that you mentioned?
Well, I think that maybe the best example of that is what happened in Florida in 2018, that on the ballot that year was a constitutional amendment to enfranchise those who were convicted of a felony. And in Florida, according to the law before it passed, you could not vote ever unless granted clemency, essentially, you're barred from voting. And there was an effort led by conservatives and Democrats to enfranchise up to 1.4 million Floridians. And again, that passed with about 65%. Of course, the Florida legislature, which is controlled by the Republicans, immediately acted to gut the law.
Yes.
So point taken there. But in terms of the grassroots level conservatives, they actually do support these issues. And that's the exciting part, that though Democratic elite politicians are largely the ones leading this effort, on the grassroots level, there are many conservative voters who really do feel alienated from our political system and want to act when given the opportunity to fix our democracy.
So let's turn now to the Democrats. You said that it's exciting that the candidates are actually making it a part of this conversation already, and it's relatively early on in the primary. Who would you say stands out as making it the biggest part of their slate of issues so far?
Right, and this is the exciting part, is that there's a growing list of candidates who, as in my organization, I work with Lawrence Lessig. I'm the campaign manager for Equal Citizens, and we have a website called POTUS1, where we track every single candidate's position on these issues. And the most important commitment we want, beyond endorsing policies, is a commitment to fixing democracy first. As the first act of a new administration, we want to see candidates commit to fixing democracy, because none of these other policy proposals matter if you don't fix the system first to allow for progressive change. And so you see a growing list of candidates. Kirsten Gillibrand, for example, in the debate said that the first thing she's going to do is fix our democracy first. So did Pete Buttigieg. Folks like Bernie Sanders for a long time have been talking about the need to get big money out of politics. But there is a growing list of, like, Pete Buttigieg, Kirsten Gillibrand, even Beto O'Rourke has said that he would fix democracy first. And that core framing is really what we're looking to see. And because it acknowledges that change is not possible until we fix our system. And it's a commitment that we can then use, if that candidate is elected, to hold their feet to the fire, to actually make this change that so many Americans want to see.
Well, let's take a look at this, the flip side then. If someone's watching this and they're a voter, they're following the primary, and this is an important set of issues to them, which candidates so far stand out as not either being clear about what they would do were they to become president, or to not seem to prioritize it at all?
Right. Well, I think there are a number of candidates that are very vague on these issues. There are a couple that just don't mention it at all. And then there are a couple like Joe Biden, where he has a couple of platitudes about supporting public financing, but no details about it whatsoever. Mm-hmm. There are 26 candidates in the field right now. And so in our POTUS1 tracker, there are a lot of candidates that score pretty lowly in our rankings. We give each candidate a grade from A to F. Donald Trump has an F for many of the things that he's done to try and undermine our political institutions, like rigging or attempting to at least rig the census, to elevate white political power in our political institutions. But then there are a lot of candidates that really aren't prioritizing this at all, let alone giving space in their policy platform to speaking to this issue that voters care so deeply about. And we're really working hard to push those candidates. Equal Citizens, we're hosting town halls across New Hampshire with presidential candidates to really sit down and talk. So what are your proposals to fixing our democracy? And we've held two so far with Andrew Yang and Kirsten Gillibrand, and they've been very well attended. So we look forward to doing more of those in the future.
Okay, well, hopefully it will continue to be a part of these debates. We've got debates coming up in less than 2 weeks. And hopefully also, as candidates start to talk about this more, voters will start to think about it and choose candidates based on this. Perhaps as they lay out more of their platforms, maybe we can bring you back on to do a little bit more evaluation in depth.
Absolutely.
Thank you again for joining us, Adam. We really appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
We're gonna take a short break here. We come back, update on the unfortunately tragic case of Eric Garner and the lack of justice revealed this morning.
Five years ago, my son said, "I can't breathe," 11 times. And today we can't breathe. That Officer Pandaleo and all the officers who was involved in my son's death that day need to be off the force.
There you're hearing the voice of Gwen Carr, mother of Eric Garner, responding to the news that either thanks to the Justice Department at large or the influence of William Barr in specific, depending on how you look at this, there will be, shockingly, no justice and no charges, and the officer is going to be just fine, it turns out, after 5 years. I honestly, maybe you agree, I can't believe it's been 5 years. And imagine the mother you saw there, and you should totally watch the entire press conference, because she talks about how that this is not the end, that she's going to continue on. She said, "You can see my face right now. You better expect you're going to see a lot more of it in the future." To have waited 5 years for some sort of justice for what happened to her son is just devastating. But let's, just in case you do not know some of the basic details of this, I want to fill you in. As of this morning, the Justice Department will not be bringing federal charges against a New York City police officer in the death of Eric Garner, just one day before the fifth anniversary of his death. Mr. Garner, who was 43 at the time, died on a Staten Island sidewalk on July 17th, 2014, after Officer Pantaleo wrapped an arm around his neck from behind and took him to the ground, and other officers put their weight on him, compressing his chest against the pavement. A medical examiner testified at the disciplinary hearing that the pressure on Mr. Garner's neck and chest set in motion a fatal asthma attack. And like, this entire story is horrendous, but sickeningly, their line is that the chokehold and the pressure didn't kill him, the asthma killed him. But he didn't just spontaneously have an asthma attack as he was walking around. He had it because you used that chokehold, because you put the pressure on him completely needlessly. And of course, as I'm sure you're aware, at that point, chokeholds had already been outlawed for years and years and years. I wonder why they tried to rein in like one of the most specific excesses of the way that police brutalize people in these areas. Maybe because it kills people. Sorry, asthma kills people. The chokehold was just sort of tangential to it, didn't have anything to do with it. In June of this year, the police department finished a disciplinary trial to determine if Officer Pantaleo should be fired or punished in some other way for using what appeared to be a chokehold. That's the New York Times once again being quite bold in their choice of language, which the department had banned more than two decades ago. So take a look at this in terms of what the other punishments might be if he's not fired, because even though this guy died because he broke the rules and had him in a chokehold for 5 years now, he's just been continuing on with his career. It's now ultimately up to Commissioner James P. O'Neill, as the final arbiter of police discipline, to decide whether to fire Officer Pantaleo or take less drastic action like docking vacation time. That is an insult in every, docking vacation time. He's been paid for 5 years. He's had 5 years of vacation in a job he should not still have. Thankfully, it seems like he hasn't been put in a position where he'll do this again. Hopefully, they've been more vigilant to their officers breaking the rules in this way, in ways that jeopardizes the lives of the people they're supposed to be protecting. But so far, Officer Pantaleo, things are going quite well for him. And let's look a little bit more about how we've gotten to this point. So to prove criminal conduct, a Justice Department official said the government had to convince a jury that in the middle of a dynamic arrest, Officer Pantaleo made a clear decision in his mind to apply a chokehold, a burden prosecutors did not believe they could meet. And I am not a police officer, and I'm not a lawyer, I'm not an official at the Justice Department, but I don't understand what anything in that paragraph means. Because they're saying they can't meet the bar of saying that he made a decision to apply a chokehold. But the thing is, I watch wrestling growing up, I've wrestled with people. Literally the only way that you wrap your arm around a person's neck and squeeze is if you decide to do that. You have to send a signal from your brain to your arm to say, put it around their neck, and you have to struggle to contain them until they eventually die, of course. None of that is involuntary. We're not talking about the pumping of the blood. We're not talking about the operation of the lungs. You can't start it and you can't continue it unless you make a conscious decision to do that. That he did. I can't say for sure that he knew that what he was doing was breaking the laws, although if he was trained at all, he should definitely know that. There's no point in making a change to regulations like that if you're not going to tell the police officers that that's the case. But there's no question that he made the conscious decision to do that. There has never in the history of mankind been an unconscious chokehold. That just does not exist. But one added layer of insult to it is that while the prosecutors sort of reflected in that statement didn't believe that they could actually make it all the way through this thing, civil rights lawyers said that they should have charges, that there should be a continuing quest for justice. And those civil rights lawyers were overruled by William Barr. As you can see in this headline, Barr sides against civil rights officials in declining to bring charges against NYPD officer in Garner case, which shows that William Barr can't just do a ton of damage in his position in DC. in trying to stop justice, you know, from like ever getting anywhere close to Donald Trump. No, his influence stretches across the country because this horrific, horrific man also gets to decide that those civil rights lawyers, they don't know what they're talking about. No charges, no justice. That's William Barr. But I will end by returning to, as we began, Gwen Carr, who's been fighting for half a decade for something like justice, who tweeted, "This is not the end. This is not the end. This is not the end." And it continues, as her quest for justice will also continue. And all those who want to see something like justice in this particular case, he can't be brought back, but perhaps there can be consequences. Okay, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, more to get to. While many Americans are unfortunately almost completely unaware about what's been going on in Sudan recently, there are people here who are fighting to do what they can to improve the situation there. And we're joined by one of those individuals right now. Coming on to talk about Sudan Rising, Bakri Ali, welcome to the show.
Thank you, John.
We're very glad to have you here. And so you've been involved in some pretty massive fundraising to help out people who have been victimized during the violence against protesters in Sudan. Can you tell us about how you got involved in this?
Sure. So again, thanks, John, and thank you for the TYT for covering Sudan. This is a time when there's a lot happening in Sudan. Unfortunately, we don't see a lot of media coverage. So thank you for doing this. And I started doing this at the very start of the uprising in Sudan and the protests, because from prior experiences, we knew that the regime is going to respond with force, and there's going to be many people affected, many casualties, many injuries. And we knew that people need our support for even basic medical care. So the people of Sudan around the world and their friends and supporters were very awesome, and they responded in an overwhelming way to our calls to collect donations and just provide medical care, provide support to people who lost a loved one in Sudan. So it's been a global effort.
And so for people who might not have been following the developments over the past half year plus, so far in the violence against protesters during this movement, how many people have been injured? How many people have been killed? How widespread is the violence?
So the numbers are all over the place. And the reason for that is there's a lot of clampdown on even media outlets. As you may have heard, there has been a disconnect of the internet in Sudan for over 25 days. That's why you hear numbers all over the place. From our estimates based on the teams that run in supporting the injured and supporting the families that lost loved ones, there's over 300 killed just since December, and there's over 3,000 injured just since December.
Well, those are obviously some massive numbers. But another massive number, you've been, as you sort of implied there, very successful with your fundraising. So far with, as you said, this global effort, how much money have you been able to raise for the people of Sudan? And what's the process been like in getting it to people to help them out with their healthcare and related things?
So again, the success has been overwhelming. We've had response from Sudanese around the world, from their friends here in America, in Canada, all over the world. And we have collected through the University of Khartoum Alumni Association, the nonprofit that I work with, we have collected over $700,000 in the past 7 months. And that has allowed us to provide free medical care for anyone impacted by the uprising, by the brutality of the regime. We've contracted with hospitals in Sudan to open the doors and just offer free treatment to anyone who comes in with an injury. We have been able to send people with severe injuries outside Sudan to places where they can receive better medical care, in places like India and Russia. And we've been able to support the uprising in many other ways. So I'll take this opportunity and thank everyone who has supported the people of Sudan throughout this. And this has been truly meaningful and has been one of the key reasons for getting to where we are today.
Well, and similarly, I mean, this is an amazing effort. I think you deserve a lot of thanks for doing this and helping to organize this. And so if anyone's watching this and would like to donate and to help the movement, what can they do? Where can they participate?
Sure, I'll answer that. But let me go back to your previous question. I don't think I provided an answer on our the mechanism with which we work. So our fundraising efforts have been largely on social media. And the way we work with the team in Sudan is we either send the money directly to the hospitals they send people to outside Sudan, or we transfer money to them in Sudan and they pay the hospitals. And we're still receiving invoices from the hospitals inside Sudan. But for anyone who would like to help, we are on Facebook. We have an active fundraising campaign labeled Food and Medicine for Sudan. That's another thing that we supported. As you may have heard, there has been a sit-in at the army headquarters in Khartoum. Tens of thousands of people participated in that. And it went on for about 2 months before it was brutally dispersed by the security forces, leading to the killing of over 120 people in 1 day. So we've been able to provide, throughout the 2 months of that sit-in, we've been able to provide medical supplies, food supplies, sanitation supplies. So again, we have an active campaign on Facebook named Food and Medicine for Sudan. And we also have an active campaign on the website CrowdRise, which is a GoFundMe website for nonprofits. We're also collecting donations through that campaign to continue supporting our people in Sudan, because many of the victims of this are going to have long-term needs, whether they have disabilities, whether they're families that lost the person who provide income for the family. So we have to be there for those people.
Well, we appreciate your efforts and joining us to update us on what's going on there. And I hope that people do take part and donate. As you point out, this is not just an issue of having to help people right now. It will be an ongoing issue possibly for the rest of their lives. So Bakary, we appreciate you joining us.
Thank you very much, John.
We're going to take one last break here and close out the show with one more block. I'm a massive fan of the James Bond movies, and so I've been eagerly anticipating any rumors about the upcoming Daniel Craig movie set to come out in 2020, possibly the last Daniel Craig James Bond. But not everybody is excited about these rumors. A certain type of man lost it over the most recent one, and here it is. The rumor comes from an anonymous source quoted in the Daily Mail. According to the Mail's source, in director Cary Fukunaga's 2020 film, Lashana Lynch takes over the role of 007 after Daniel Craig's James Bond goes into retirement. The Daily Mail reports that Craig also remains a major part of the story. His Bond rapidly comes out of retirement during the film in order to face off against Rami Malek's villain. And the issue there is that Lashana Lynch has made the fatal flaw, the fatal mistake of being a black woman who's going to play 007. And so they've lost it. And I, as soon as I saw this, I thought that's gonna be his monologue.
It's great.
And I only mentioned, we're gonna show you some of Ben Shapiro. I only mentioned him because, you know, he's the patron saint of incels and all that. They can't take
Jordan
this
Peterson.
Sort of thing.
Yeah, they can't handle it. Basically, I mean, we talked about this a little bit before. And if you were to write down what you think Ben Shapiro's problem with it is, that is exactly his problem with it.
Yeah.
Where like something about society changing, man, is keeping you from getting laid. No, it's totally society, man. That's all it is. Women, I'm entitled to them. And I'm a man. And everything that implies that I'm having failures with trying to land a lady is not my own responsibility. It's that she doesn't understand she's my property.
Exactly. And I want movies that tell her that she is. So I want to give just brief credit to author John Scalzi, who tweeted prediction, whiny dudes will be shaken and stirred. And they were. So let's show you one. This is Ben Shapiro talking about James Bond.
To take a perfectly obvious example, number one, there's this movie trope that 130 pound soaking wet woman can knock over a 200 pound man who is physically trained. That's absurd. It's absurd in the extreme. One of the things about the Bond series is that Daniel Craig is ripped beyond belief and he can beat the crap out of anyone. And so that at least that part of the movie is plausible. If you're talking about somebody who's a bowling ball of a human going into other people and breaking them up, that makes a lot more sense. There's less suspension of disbelief along those lines if it turns out that the hero is actually physically large. And that is one aspect of James Bond. And then there's the other aspect, right? Because Bond is about the guns and the girls. When it comes to the seduction of women, there is a very, very large difference between a woman and a man. Now, I'm not even going to get into the lesbian aspect of this because I don't know if this character is going to be a lesbian. Let's assume that she's not for a second. Let's assume that she is just black female James Bond, which means that she's betting the most handsome men. That is not in any way a wish fulfillment fantasy for the men who typically watch the Bond films, because disproportionate share of the Bond audience is male. So unless you're completely shifting the character, it makes no sense.
It's so many different types of pathetic. Yeah, yeah, an attractive, capable woman hunting you down and seducing you. That's not a fantasy for men.
First of all, did it weird anyone else out when he said soaking wet woman? That freaked me out so much. It took me a full minute to recover. Also, this bowling ball trope of Donald Trump, of James Bond is new. That is a drastic change from previous James Bond. Previous James Bond,
true James
actually,
Bond fans knows that.
But like, he is a suave, debonair person originally.
Classy.
The image, the early image that you had in, I think, in Casino Royale, when Daniel Craig is chasing the parkour villain and he barrels through some drywall, like that was a change for James Bond that was mandated to happen because of James Bond being exposed by Austin Powers as a ridiculous person.
Yes, and they put that early in Casino Royale to tell you this is a different sort of James Bond.
So they've already adapted it in a way that is not good for Ben Shapiro. Ben Shapiro is not gonna get laid more because Daniel Craig is strong and say, you know, Timothy Dalton was a little like more live.
Well, but Timothy Dalton at least was in another one of the gritty ones. The idea that like James Bond, the movie series will fail if it ever changes. Like, have you watched any of them? They change all the time. Every single different James Bond is, it's a different tone. It's almost a different genre.
How did he feel about the black exploitation era of James
Bond? Yeah, and the fact that, like, I'm so glad that you pointed out that Daniel Craig, like how different he is. Daniel Craig was protested because he wasn't British enough. He wasn't suave enough and debonair enough.
Blonde.
But now it's just, it's baked in for a few years and it's like, this is the hill I will die on. It can never go away from this particular James Bond. I will say this with all confidence. I'm a bigger fan of James Bond than Ben Shapiro.
Yeah.
And I'm not terrified of this at all. I love that they made M a woman for a while. They eventually backtracked on that. She was an awesome addition.
It's also a job. Like, M is a job. 007 is not James Bond. James Bond is 007.
And James Bond is still in the movie. She's not going to be James Bond. It wouldn't be an issue if she was. But this is him. He, by the way, and we're not showing you the full video. He didn't have all the details. He's responding. I know he's the facts, you know, don't care about your feelings guy. But this is the knee jerk triggered Ben Shapiro, who doesn't care enough about this issue to actually learn what's going on in the movie. He just like starts talking and shaking and not looking at the camera and not making eye contact.
It is absolutely ridiculous that you would have a young, soaking wet lesbian woman barrel through someone. You know what's believable is when a laser shoots the world and a man has diamonds in his face.
Exactly.
That's believable.
And when a guy like windsurfs away from the tidal wave created by an orbiting laser hitting this is a movie. This is not about facts. This is about feelings, and his feelings have been hurt.
He should do masculine things like pursue people in skis.
What was the lesbian thing? Let's assume she's not
so
a lesbian.
Weird.
Why are you assuming that she would be a lesbian? And why would that be an issue? In fact, if what you want to see is a 00 agent betting the most attractive women, shouldn't that fix the problem for you? But he has to assume. He has to assume so that he has another issue with it. Because it's not enough that he obviously doesn't like that it's a woman. He's not stating it, but he clearly doesn't like that it's a black woman. But he's just horrified that it could be a lesbian too.
I just wrote down, you said lesbian.
He said lesbian.
You brought that up.
And here's the thing. In every one of these cases where they're just freaking out that a movie is changing, as movies always do, it's always about the continuity and the canonical nature of this movie. It's not about general things. Just, I love James Bond and Ghostbusters and all of these things. And it's weird that it's always an issue that women get into any of these movies. It almost seems like that's the real issue.
And
not that you care that much about Marvel or that much about James Bond or whatever.
And they might have some kind of capitalist argument that is bearing out in the women's favor. Like, that's the problem, is they're like, they should default back to let the audience decide. It is not MGM. It is not these studios. It's not, I don't know if it's even still United Artists, but like, it's not those studios that are saying we need to branch out. It is borne out time and time again that the box office bottom line favors blockbuster movies that incorporate women.
Exactly.
In a way that is not proprietary to the male lead.
And here's a crazy thought. I love James Bond and I want women to like James Bond too.
Yes.
It's not an issue if you change a little bit. You still got Daniel Craig for this last one. Anyway, thank you as always. Join us. Great to have
pleasure.
You here. And producing in the background. Thank you everybody who's watching. We've got a big week planned. JR will be joining us tomorrow. So we will see you tomorrow morning. Time now for a little debate. Obviously, Donald Trump has been dominating headlines over the last few days for his insanely racist attack against four women of color in the US government. But is this all just a distraction? That was sort of the point that AOC and other members of the squad made during their press conference yesterday. We are joined now by Brett Ehrlich. Is this all just a distraction?
What a weird framing. Like the reason to call it
We'll frame it however you want.
Right. But just a distraction. Like that term itself feels like a distraction, because a distraction from what? And I think that during that press conference, the squad, which I am having to call them now, the squad.
I'm fine with it. They like it, so I like it.
They did a really good job of essentially saying, we are calling this a distraction and we're using this opportunity of you guys cutting to us to outline our vision for America, which is something that has been lacking from the establishment of the party. So Nancy Pelosi has, for all of the angling that she's done and the ways that she's kind of censured unofficially the behavior of these women, she hasn't offered an alternative in terms of like a well-articulated vision for the party, and that's her job. So that's what they tried to do yesterday when they put together that press conference. And I think in calling it a distraction, you're doing something with this moment.
And you worded that right. You have to have the vision and you have to articulate it well. You have to have both of those things. And even if Nancy Pelosi was on our side on the biggest issues, I wouldn't want her to be the one trying to deliver on it, because she can't communicate those values in the same way that AOC and others can. I think it's fine for, like, I to some extent disagree that it's that talking about it is a distraction, whether we want to use the word just or not. I mean, obviously the way that they handled that press conference is the way that they've done everything. It's issues focused. Here's our agenda. Here's what we're going to do, and differentiate themselves from Donald Trump on the most substantive of grounds. And that's one of the things that I respect most about them. But Donald Trump is an insane racist and he's the president and I despise him. And I don't know if it's a great weakness of mine or a great strength, but I want to wage this war on what is real, what is true, and you know, some of the awful people that are leading us. And so I feel like I had to respond to it this morning.
Yeah.
I mean, we then turned to other issues and you know, we talked about Eric Garner, we talked about Sudan, we talked about James Bond, the three biggest issues in the news, obviously. But I agree with the point that there are other issues that he doesn't want us to talk about. And so I tried to, every once in a while, I try to like touch base with reality by just not referencing the news, just what are the important things that we could be forgetting about. And so I just quickly wrote down, his tax plan totally didn't deliver, was a complete waste of trillions of dollars and didn't stimulate the economy. He's working with MBS despite the fact that he hacked apart a journalist. He wants a war with Iran, almost brought us to one just a couple of weeks ago, and is probably going to resume that very soon. He has shredded environmental regulations, doing nothing about climate change, and just to give a big speech about how awesome he is on an issue that he doesn't even accept exists. Pre-existing conditions, he wants to get rid of them. He's supposedly gonna have a healthcare plan that's a couple weeks away. He's been saying that for literally years. Epstein, what is the connection with Donald Trump? We don't know, but he definitely doesn't want us to. The concentration camps continue. They have not in any way been fixed in the past couple of days. North Korea, there's been no progress there, even though he wants you to believe it's a massive success of diplomacy. He has no positive agenda for America, which they, of course, differentiate themselves against very well. And he and Mitch McConnell are blocking literally anything to protect our elections from foreign interference. That's just stuff that I just wrote down.
So there are
a lot of issues. I did it in like the 45 seconds before the show started.
Gotcha.
The last one took a second.
I don't think you have to choose something here. I think what in terms of like, is it a distraction thing, something else? You do have to choose your stance on it rhetorically. And I think that look at what, every time Trump does something like this, these tweets were the worst. They were the worst. Because he's now a president, so it wasn't quite, they're sending rapists, they're murderers. That was before he was president. Now he is president, and him saying go back to your country when they are absolutely American citizens is insanity. And it's wildly racist. And I think what he does in that is he's going to normalize this as fast as he can. Mm-hmm. And CNN was doing that work for him this morning when Mark Meadows gets out and holds a press conference. And during that press conference, Meadows says, oh, he's not racist. These women have said terrible things about Israel. So what he does is he kind of wedges that door of racism open a little further by saying something worse than he's ever said and letting it be normalized in a second. And now he's also established that conversation about, all right, let's compare terrible statements.
Yeah.
The only problem is if you're on the left, you have this instinct to ground yourself in reality, and people on the right just want to say stuff that they want to say. So when he says, let's compare terrible things these people have said about Israel, then Mark Meadows is referencing something that doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Or is wildly mischaracterized. So the question is, what time do you have to spend? Do you have to spend time setting the record straight? Because who does that affect? And I would say, unfortunately, by what I said about CNN, it has affected mainstream media coverage of things.
Yeah.
And that's a problem. Trump saying terrible stuff to his base, who is not going to change anyway, that's not the problem. But Trump and Meadows working together and CNN allowing them to kind of determine what this narrative is in a way that does not at every step of the way point out the ridiculousness of what Trump and his cronies are trying to set as the record, that is a problem that we need to address.
Yeah. Super fast, I just want to tag on to the end. Two things that happened this morning, sort of related. So Kellyanne Conway being asked questions outside of the White House, a reporter asked her a question and she asks him his ethnicity. Seems sort of weird to do like the day or two after this.
Trump did this with a Mexican judge.
Yep, he did.
And this is a problem. Just everyone needs to remember along the way that until only racist, terrible people yell, go back where you came from. Mm-hmm. No non-racist, non-terrible person has ever gone, go back to your country. Like that's
it's
a horrible thing.
Happened.
And until people on the right break their silence and condemn that action, or at least call it what it is, which is racism, everything they're saying is patently ridiculous and should not be trusted because they're calling something that is racist, not racist. Even if they say xenophobic.
Which
I don't hate people that are different. I'm afraid of them, which paints themselves as snowflakes, by the way. That's a phobia means fear. Mm-hmm. You're scared of it. And xeno means outside. So you're afraid of things that are outside you. Those things outside you are not your same color. You're racist.
Mm-hmm. So you're pretty clear on this. Okay, so I wish the New York Times would take the same tack that you did. The other thing, by the way, super quick. Sometimes I don't know if I'm crazy. Kellyanne Conway was on the news. I don't know which one. One of the news is, and she said that the squad is the dark underbelly of America. Which, like,
they're not even coding it anymore.
Am I crazy? I know that's an expression, but like, did she just randomly choose that?
I want to. She knows she's doing it. She's the worst. Those folks are the worst. I just want to leave with this. The way that people on the right and in the media treat the word racist, and I told you this, but like, they treat racist, like as soon as you say it, they want to treat you like their customer service and you just use the F word.
Mm-hmm.
Now they don't have to deal with you. Oh, he said racist. This conversation is over. You're calling me racist. That's evil. Why can't I treat people being racist like I'm the customer service rep and they just drop the N word?
Mm-hmm.
And I can say, sorry, this is above me. It's above me now.
You can try. Unfortunately, we sometimes have to interact with these people.
There is no answer. There's no reason why we can't do that. We just need to do it. Be like, moving on. You're racist. That was racist. Conversation over.
Conversation over.
This felt more like a think tank episode.
Yeah, I just wanted to hear what you thought about this.
Thank you.
Anyway, that's all the time we have. Okay, we'll see you on the other side.
He's lying. We have infinite time. This wasn't in the main live linear show, so we can just go on.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adarola. I'll see you soon.